I'm thinking, find my glasses, and I'm ready to go. Good afternoon, Your Honor, Your Honors. My name is Stuart Bennett, number 5682. I'm representing the appellant and plaintiff below, Scott Cunningham. As you know from the briefs, this appeal involves, from the appellant standpoint, the trial court's misinterpretation of the legal effects of three contracts.
Can we get to the record for just a moment?
Yes.
I want to be sure we, in the record, we're clear. I read Mr. Cunningham's testimony, which Judge McGahee rejected as not credible, and Mr. Miller's testimony,
yes,
which the court was persuaded by. Were there, as I read it, all the other witnesses were peripheral, damages or others. These were the only two witnesses, these men who knew what was going on at the time, or did I miss something?
No, those are essentially the two witnesses that testified on those issues.
Okay, thank you. Number two question, you're not objecting to any of the findings of fact by Judge McGahee. You're arguing that he made mistakes as a matter of law.
Yes.
Are there mixed questions of law and fact here? And that's where I'm having a little difficulty separating them. For example, let's go right to the limitata.
Yes, ma'am.
And he found that that was irrelevant, but let's look at that. It made certain transfers. Did he make any findings about those transfers? Who actually owned what and got what?
He did not.
Okay, why do you think that's important for your case?
Because the limitata is the only entity as to license P209 that owned the beneficial interest in the license. And he construed these contracts, the two assignments that we're interested in, the carried working interest assignments, in the course of the English law phase, where he held his 44-1 hearing. He determined that these contracts obligated the beneficial owners of the license to pay a percentage of the net profits if and when received. What he did not do is he never determined who the beneficial owners of the license were. Instead, he assumed, or he looked, and it doesn't make it clear whether he actually makes this assumption, but I think the necessary implication of his order is that he did. So he assumes that these partnerships had an interest, had a beneficial interest in the license, which they exchanged for stock, and then when the stock was received and Mr. Cunningham got some stock, that extinguished his interest.
Let me interrupt for a second.
And, sure.
Let's assume that, as a panel, we disagree with Judge McGahee that the limitata was irrelevant.
Okay.
Then, as an appellate court, what do we do? We can't make factual findings.
Right.
So if all we said was, well, we think he got it wrong that it was irrelevant here, then what's the result?
I think the only course of action at that point is to remand the case to Judge McGahee to consider the role of the limitata. He had made the determination that the beneficial owners had to pay the contracts. It's our position it was the limitata that was a beneficial owner. He said it's irrelevant. The order then to him is determine who the beneficial owners of the license were. You've said, Judge, that they're the ones that are obligated on this contract. What you didn't do, Judge McGahee, is decide who that was. He sort of assumed, I think you can read this into his opinion, that it was the partnerships that were the beneficial owners. And that assumption is directly contradicted by the documents that he had before him and the evidence that he received on the English law portion. The English law portion, by the way, is also a question of law, which you can review de novo.
But nobody's appealing that part of the case.
No, we're perfectly satisfied with Judge McGahee's understanding and ruling on English law. He said only people who have the consent of the government may own an interest in a license. But what he further said was that these carried working interest assignments were not an assignment of an interest in the license. They were a contractual obligation of the beneficial owner to pay a percentage of the net profits if and when received.
Can I follow up your question?
Please.
There's one other
excuse me, there's one other thing I want to clear up, that, and that is the LLC, the Wyoming LLC. That was created under Wyoming's laws. Please explain the difference in the legal effect of the Limitada, which was the Panamanian, and the Wyoming LLC, if any.
In terms of their role in this case, there's no difference. The Limitada was used at a time when there was no law anywhere in the country that allowed for the use of an LLC. The remarkable thing about the Hamilton companies is they went to Wyoming and they got the legislature to adopt the statute that first created an LLC. And they did it for the purposes so they could use it in these kinds of arrangements. So the role of the Limitada and the Wyoming LLC was the same.
Is your argument as to the who's the beneficial owner of the stock the same?
The beneficial owner of the license.
Of the license,
yes.
Right.
In each case, and let me explain how that beneficial ownership comes about, because it's in the documents. The bare title holder was the licensee that the license was issued to. In the case of P209, it was Hamilton Brothers Oil Company, Great Britain Limited. And in the case of the 1977 license, P276, the license was originally issued to British Petroleum, BP. There was a cross-assignment where BP and Hamilton entered into cross-assignments. They each assigned a piece of a license that they each owned. The BP cross-assignment, which is also in the evidence, assigns an interest in P276 to the same company, Hamilton Brothers Oil Company, Great Britain Limited. That company was an affiliate of all of our assignors in our assignments. So that's the bare title holder. Then, under English law, in order for an American company to have the right to an English license, the proceeds from an English license, they entered into what were called illustrative agreements. And one of those is Exhibit C3, I think it is, in the evidence. And what that does is it say, we bear license holder are holding this license for you. You undertake to pay all of the costs of development, and in exchange, you get all of the rights to the license. The rights in the license are to search, bore for, and get petroleum. So these two entities, the Limitada and the Wyoming LLC, are the beneficial owners of the license pursuant to illustrative agreements. Now, it's indisputable in this case that no other entity, no other Hamilton entity, ever had the beneficial ownership of these licenses. Not these partnerships, not any other entity, until 1983 with respect to P276, and 1990 with respect to P209, the Wyoming LLC and the Limitada were liquidated, and they were merged, and their assets were conveyed to Hamilton Oil Great Britain PLC. That entity is the same company as the original licensee, Hamilton Oil Great Britain Limited. It just changed its name in 1981 when it went public. So the Limitada, the Wyoming LLC, owned the beneficial interest in the licenses from the day they were formed until the day they merged with this Hamilton Oil Great Britain. Hamilton Oil Great Britain is the direct predecessor in interest to the defendants here, BHP Petroleum Great Britain PLC, by virtue of a bunch of mergers.
The last sentence of these CWI assignment documents says, in the event of an exchange of any of the properties, capital P properties,
right,
the acquired property shall replace the property exchange, and the interest shall apply to the acquired property. Give me your best summary of what your interpretation of that sentence is and how, if at all, it's applicable here.
I believe that exchange language, you understand the court said that exchange language applied.
I understand.
Judge McGahee said. We say, no, it doesn't. The reason being is it refers to an exchange of properties. Properties are defined in the assignment on the first page as an undivided carried working interest of 10% in and to all partnership oil and gas properties, herein called, quote, the cap properties, close quote. They are oil and gas properties. They're not stock. They're not quotas of the Limitada. They are oil and gas properties. Now, the reason why that has to be true under these agreements is because the properties that are acquired become subject to the carried working interest, to the, no, to the carried working interest. And they are subject to the terms of payout. And if you look at what you have to do in order to calculate payout under these assignments, you have to look at all of the costs of exploring and developing and producing the oil and gas properties. You have to compare that with the revenues, all the revenues that are associated with the oil and gas properties, to determine payout. You cannot do that with a share of stock.
So is my understanding of what you're saying is that this paragraph would, or that sentence would cover a situation where you might have leases up in the North Sea up here, and for whatever reason, the managers decide, no, we don't like those. We'll exchange those for some other leases 50 miles away, and those new leases would be subject to the CWIs.
Exactly. We have that exact situation in the cross assignment. Hamilton actually acquired license P257. They cross assigned with BP to get license P276. So the piece of 276 that they got by virtue of this cross assignment would become subject to the provisions of the carried working interest, because it is an exchanged property. What Judge McKay could have properly done, in my view, is taken the fact that if they had sold these properties, these oil and gas properties, for stock and received stock, could have treated it as a sale, because there is a provision in the carried working interest assignment that says if you dispose of the properties, whatever you get in exchange or as consideration is credited towards payout. So you value the stock and say, okay, this is the value we got. They didn't do that. And the reason they didn't do it is because they never really exchanged anything. They took the quotas of the Limitada, which weren't owned by the partnerships, by the way, despite what VHP says in its briefs. They were owned by Fred, Ferris, Hamilton, and A.J. Miller. The reason for that is that under Panamanian law, only individuals could own quotas. So they set up this situation where Fred, Ferris, and A.J. would own the quotas. So those are the guys that owned this Limitada. They sold those quotas. There's an assignment in the record from A.J. and Fred and Hamilton to HIOC in exchange for stock. Fred and Ferris Hamilton controlled 80% of HIOC by virtue of this exchange. So they took the ownership of the Limitada out of one Hamilton pocket, and they put it over here in this Hamilton pocket. Nothing of substance changed. They still owned the interests. And they continued to own them until they liquidated them into this English company, HOGB, Hamilton Oil Great Britain, in 1990. That's why we claim this transaction had no substantive effect on the employees' carried working interests. Shouldn't have. Now the court didn't read, and that's an overstatement, didn't understand or properly interpret the exchange agreement. Because if he had, he would see there was nothing in the properties that was exchanged. The exchange agreement's very clear, and we quoted in our reply brief. It shows that the quotas of the Limitada were exchanged for HIOC stock. All that happens by virtue of that is the Limitada is now owned by HIOC. It still owns the properties. It still has the obligation to pay the employees. Nothing changed.
Well, could I ask another question?
Yes,
and did not find this in the record. Is Mr. Cunningham the only plaintiff objecting to these two payoffs of these two licenses?
Yes.
Okay. Is that important?
I don't think so.
I want to ask about the relevancy of his failure to object over the decades that Judge McGahee found important. Did that come up just because of the statute of limitations, or did it have any other asserted meaning that he didn't object?
Judge McGahee gave that some additional meaning. Judge McGahee interpreted that, I believe, and his order's not entirely clear again, but I believe, I'm running out of time. I was going to reserve some time, but I'll answer your question anyway.
Thank you.
He believed that to be course of performance. And he said Mr. Cunningham didn't object from the time that he got the stock in 1986.
Right. I know what he did with it, but what do you say?
I say that Mr. Cunningham's acceptance of the stock and the failure to complain has no legal relevance, because he was entitled to performance of the CWIs. Even though he got some performance, he was at liberty under the doctrine of defective performance to remain silent and demand full performance when performance became due after payout.
Was there any evidence whether Mr. Cunningham, as a key person in this organization, had any right to make an adjustment? Was there negotiation about what the payout would be along the way?
There is no evidence of any negotiation. What there is that there's the evidence of Mr. Miller's letters, and there's three of them, a 79, an 82, and an 86 letter, all in the record, where he describes what Hamilton is going to do. No one has ever asked to consent. No one has ever asked to sign or agree to anything. It's just done by fiat.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett.
I'm sorry to run over time.
No, that's okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Frank Parada, 27131 for the appellees, defendants below, BHP Billiton Petroleum Great Britain PLC, BHP Petroleum UK Corporation, and Hamilton Brothers Petroleum Corporation. Briefly, a prior order of the court mentioned the issue of jurisdiction needed to be addressed by the panel. I don't have a lot to say on that. The notice of appeal is obviously untimely, and that's a jurisdictional
time
issue.
Time is short, Mr. Parada. So could we just get to the limitata, and would you start by answering Judge Loeb's question to your opponent, which is, assume we don't agree that it was irrelevant. What do we do with it?
Well, if you don't agree, that's not enough. The trial court's findings must be clearly erroneous and not supported by the record. The sanctity of the trial court's findings are very important.
Given, but help us out here. All I read in the order from Judge McGeehy was the limitata really has no bearing on this case. It's irrelevant. I agree we're bound by his factual findings,
sure.
But did he make any on the limitata? And I missed
Well,
it.
He didn't need to, because he made factual findings that the limitata is not party to the assignments. If we take a look at paragraph 18, which nobody says is incorrect, he tells us that Oil Co. and certain affiliates and Petcor, what I call Hamilton Brothers Petroleum Corporation, made assignments on behalf of participants in the 1971 joint venture. Then, in paragraph 23, he tells us...
exchange agreement.
No, these are the 19... This is the carried working interest assignment from 1971.
Thank you.
That relate to what Mr. Attorney Bennett and I call license P209. Since we have two licenses, we have to do everything twice in this case. But he tells us in paragraph 18 that the assignments were made on behalf of the 71 joint venture. And then in paragraph 23, he tells us who the members of the joint venture were.
And that's because those assignments were made by people or entities who had the right to make them because they had a beneficial interest in the licenses, right?
Well, they had beneficial interest in the licenses in a very broad sense. Let's take Hamilton Brothers Petroleum Corporation. It's not a licensee. It has a subsidiary whose name is on the license. It's not party to an illustrative agreement. It has a subsidiary that's party to an illustrative agreement. But ultimately, it benefits. The credible Mr. Miller's records, the credible Mr. Miller's testimony, is that the money to the joint venture, to Explorer, comes from Hamilton Brothers Petroleum Corporation, and the profits would ultimately end up there. The same is true for the partnerships. They're not licensees. They're not party to an illustrative agreement. There are laws, there are economic reasons to develop a corporate structure. In this case, a relatively interesting one, the use of a Panamanian limitada, which is interesting but irrelevant because they're not party to the contract. What's interesting about it is that here in Denver, Colorado, somebody found this entity and it became the predecessor to an LLC. But it didn't make any assignments, just part of the structure.
Didn't make any assignments, but did it get transferred interests in the properties where by people who did properly make those assignments?
Well, it was part of the structure so that the money could come down from the partnerships to go explore and then go back up to the partnerships in a way that maximized tax benefits and protected some of these partnerships with limited liability, because at that time they had no LLCs. When the LLC is developed, they use a different structure. But the profits and the intent to profit remains with the partnerships. And they're the only people that are ultimately going to profit, and they're the only people that Judge McGahee found were going to have profits to hand out to the key employees. You see, for 77, in paragraph 13, Judge McGahee talks about the 77 joint venture and the assignments. Now, he didn't list out all the corporate and partnership entities there. He incorporates them by reference by referring to the assignments where they're named. Might be a stylistic complaint. Maybe it would be nice if he listed them out right there, but that doesn't make it clearly erroneous, and it doesn't make it unsupported by the record, because this court can look at those exhibits and see the names of the assignors. And those assignors promised some profits from this property. And then Judge McGahee made findings of fact about the exchange. And in doing so, he said, the way these partnerships, the way these key employees understood this transaction and understood the assignments for 30 years is right. That's what they intended. And when Mr. Cunningham, for the first time, without complaint, without objection, I remember he found Mr. Cunningham was a senior executive, management committee. Surely he knew how to object in a conference room if he wished. Never said anything. That's much more relevant than the limitata, because it shows what Mr. Cunningham's understanding and intent was for 30 years before the Bruce Field and these licenses did pay out, and he decided he was better off if this exchange had never taken place. The other key employees, and they were identified in the record, they're the partnership certifications that Miller kept track of everybody's interests in. They never complained then. They never complain now.
This goes back to one of the questions that was asked earlier. It seems to be that in the judge's findings, he's using this whole issue about no objection to go to the question of what's the proper interpretation of the language. Was it also argued for certain affirmative defenses like estoppel and waiver and things like that? Because he didn't mention that.
No. It was argued at trial for the intent of the parties. And Judge McGahee, he certainly got the law right. He starts with the law about contract interpretation. He tells us that the primary goal is to determine the intent of the parties. He looked at the contract the way he was supposed to. He quotes the language about the exchange agreement. I mean, exchanges are governed in these assignments. And it says if the assignors, the partnerships, the corporate entities, not the limitata, make assignments of one property for another, then the new property comes in. Well, the employees don't end up worse off or better off.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. When it talks about exchanges of property, is it talking about exchange of oil and gas interests, or is it talking about stuck?
Well, it could be both because of the way properties is defined.
Take me through that.
Well, properties is defined broadly to even mean personal properties. And the credible Mr. Miller testified that quotas, which would be shares in the Panamanian Limitada, can be properties under here. It must be, because that's what the partnerships own. And so when you trade quotas, even though they're not an oil and gas lease or license, that's what moves. The structure that they put in place to maximize everybody's profits, the joint ventures and the employees, doesn't require that it be an actual field. And for 30 years, nobody thought there was anything wrong about that. The numerous employees, the parties to the assignments, the Hamilton Brothers management, or Mr. Cunningham.
Is that a factual finding, or is the interpretation of what properties means in that paragraph simply a legal conclusion?
Oh, no, I think it's a factual finding here, because the plaintiff argued that that clause, exchanges, is ambiguous and presented extrinsic evidence.
And what do you say? Is it ambiguous or unambiguous?
Well, originally I said it was ambiguous, but when I lost the motion in limine, I have no choice but to say it's unambiguous. I mean, it's ambiguous to a degree, but quite frankly, ambiguity doesn't matter here. Given the 30 years, of course, of performance evidence, so all Miller's records, all Miller's documents, whether we admit that conditionally to determine whether it's ambiguous, or admit that to resolve the ambiguity, doesn't matter, we get to the same exact place. That there was never any ambiguity, everybody understood until Mr. Cunningham started his lawsuit. So in this case, that is a factual finding. We'd get to the same place even if it was a question of law, because you can't read that and find it to be ambiguous given the course of performance evidence, which puts it in context. Judge Rothenberg mentioned the credible Mr. Miller, and I think it's worth remembering here that we have an unusual case in that we have contracts going back to the 1970s. And maybe it's lucky that we were able to find two witnesses even that go back that far. But remember who Mr. Miller is in the record evidence. He was the Hamiltons, essentially their CFO. It was his job and his staff's job to keep track of all these joint ventures, the partnerships, the percentages. He was also a key employee that received assignments that relate to these licenses. He kept numerous records. He was examined about the meaning of these contracts, the 71 assignments and the 78 assignments. He was examined about his records. So, A6 is one of them, E5 is another. It made sense that he would keep records. He would want his colleagues and fellow employees to know how much they would be owed 30 years down the road. He was examined about his certifications to his partners in the partnership, telling them exactly what percentages they had. He was examined about his correspondence before the exchange, during the exchange, and after the exchange, telling his partners and other employees exactly how everybody understood this phrase regarding the exchange of properties and exactly how he was accounting for it. He was examined regarding the letter, the stock certificates that he sent or had sent to Mr. Cunningham in 86. And with all this, and he was up on the stand for the better part of a trial day, 300 pages in the transcript, Judge McGahee found him and his testimony credible.
Just out of curiosity, and only if it's in the record, How much money are we talking about here that's in dispute in this case?
Well, it is in the record, in part anyway. Mr. Cunningham's claims were for approximately $6 million. With interest, I think it came to $10 million. And that's just Mr. Cunningham. I think in the record is that he has about 20% of this. In other words, the 80% who think everything is perfectly right and haven't complained, haven't sued, have sent no letter, Mr. Miller, who's testified that it's right, I mean, that would make the number go much higher. On the other hand, I'm just going to end with this. You saw what Ms. Judge McGahee, an experienced trial judge and former trial lawyer, said about Mr. Cunningham. He had the chance to watch him. He had the chance to listen to him. He had the chance to hear Mr. Cunningham testify about getting stock in 86, putting his receive stamp on there and saying, I forgot, I don't know why I took the stock. And he made determinations. And those are, I think, incredibly sanctified, because it's the trial judge who, even though we have records today, you can read them, it's different than seeing them. But Judge McGahee's findings that Mr. Miller is credible, Mr. Cunningham isn't, is really the beginning and the end of this court's role, because there's more than enough evidence in here to reach that conclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Perotta. Thank you to both counsel for your excellent briefs and arguments. The case will stand submitted, and opinion will issue in due course. That finishes our 130 docket.